Six Music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
Hello and welcome, I'm Matt Everett and this is The First Time, where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments and songs that shape their lives and their careers. You sometimes get tired of describing musicians with phrases like startlingly original or genuinely innovative. It's a bit like calling someone a music legend. It's very rarely true and it's just become something of a cliche. But when it comes to Björk, it's impossible to deny her unique nature as an artist and the constantly evolving style of her music. Björk's career has been as unpredictable as her output. She found international fame in the Sugar Cubes in the mid-80s, but her musical career actually started when she was just 11 years old. Her first album at that age made her a star in her native Iceland. Since then, she found huge international success with her album debut before releasing a string of acclaimed records, immersing herself in dance music, electronica, the avant-garde, pop, film soundtracks and jazz with equal enthusiasm and skill. She's also made some incredible videos, produced some jaw-droppingly ambitious stage shows, and worked with a list of collaborators that includes Tom York, Timbaland, Nelly Hooper and the Kronos Quartet. This year she releases Biophilia, a fully interactive app album, something that illustrates how she's refusing to conform to any preconceived ideas of how music should be presented. For all those reasons, I'm honoured to have her on The First Time. And I started asking Björk, as I ask everyone on the show, when was she first aware of music?
I can't really remember one particular moment, but I do remember
record collection in my house, and I guess I was brought by my mom and my stepdad to cut a really long story short, they were hippies. So there would be this big chunk of vinyl in front of the record player, and they would be renting the apartment with different people all the time. So basically it'd be like a queue at the record player. Well, not literally a queue, but every you would listen to a record and then it would be turned around and then somebody would just be waiting to put the next one on.
Yeah.
So it would never stop. I remember that, and I remember going through the records and looking at the pictures.
Which kind of records do you remember being fascinated by?
Well, I remember checking out the pictures of things like some Frank Zappa covers. Pretty trippy. Yeah, my mama cried.
Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Yeah, that's pretty far out, if you're very small.
And, you know, like Joni Mitchell.
Honey, you turn me on, I'm a radio, I'm a country station, I'm a little bit corny, I'm a wildflower, waiting for you, broadcasting tower, waiting for you.
And my stepfather's a guitarist, so there'd be bands like Cream, Jimi Hendrix, this kind of music was in my household.
What was the first record that you owned that was yours, that belonged to you?
With all this kind of prog music in my house and hippie music or whatever, I rebelled at the age of 7.
Obviously.
And bought Kimono My House with Sparks.
That's a good album.
Which I think my parents thought was strange pop music, you know? So it was kind of silly music, you know? Which I really enjoyed, you know? So that was my rebellion. So I played that album about 5 billion times. Every time it was my turn in the key.
Visually, already, I mean, visually, Sparks were a very strong band, so was that appealing to you early on?
Yeah, both. I loved his voice. You know, I guess it was kind of like a bit, I don't know what it was, quite feminine, I guess, and quite sort of possessed or something. It definitely wasn't like rock and roll.
Domestic crying, and when this world is as near, do not show any fear. Heart
Your first album was recorded when you were very, very young, about 11, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about recording that record?
I remember going in the studio and being introduced to the studio first time, and the engineer, like, recording my voice and playing it backwards, and I was like, oh my God, you know, fast, and I'm the Smurfs, and whatever. So these kind of things. And it was mostly grown-ups, you know, well, all grown-ups except me. And so they were like, you know, I was being taught about the microphone and pronouncing lyrics quite clearly and these kind of things. But I mean, Iceland's different, you know. At that time, Reykjavik had 80,000 people, and the album sold, I think, if I remember it right, 5,000 copies. So it went gold or whatever. But I mean, still in Iceland, everybody knows each other anyway. So it's not such a big deal like it would have been if it was here, you know.
You got really into punk music in your teens. Who was the first punk band you fell in love with?
That's a good question, because I mean, I was kind of the youngest. A lot of the people I was hanging out at that time were like 3 or 4 years older than me. And I kind of liked the spirit more of punk and the sort of idea of indie labels and DIY and all this kind of stuff. And I wasn't that crazy about the music. Obviously, I would like something like Sushi and the Banshees, but I never owned their albums. I would sort of hear it more in parties. Like, the records I owned and cherished was more like Kate Bush. But I think that Peter Pan song on her second album.
What is it about that tune?
Not sure. I mean, I wasn't that sharp in English back then. But I just really understood the emotion. It was really sort of feminine and very sort of possessed and emotional and very open. And it wasn't so structured. The structure was more like liquid or something. And I guess I understood in my sort of naive ways that here was a structure that was not square like rock and roll and punk and masculine somehow, but it was more curvy.
It's been such a long week, so much crying.
I believe.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time with my guest today, Björk. That was Kate Bush with In Search of Peter Pan from her second album, 1978's Lionheart. Following her formative punk-edged band, Björk then went on to form The Sugar Cubes, the group that would eventually introduce her incredible voice to the world. I asked her what the band's first rehearsals were like.
I was in quite a few bands as a teenager, and then I started in 82 in a band called Kukl, which actually had three of us went on to start The Sugar Cubes. Mm-hmm. So in a way, half of The Sugar Cubes had been together for 5 years before. Kukl was an odd band because the punk scene in Iceland had many bands, and then there was this radio show on like the John Peel of Iceland. He was told that he couldn't have a show anymore in Iceland, and everybody was just devastated, and he decided for his last show to pick his favourite members from six favourite bands and start, like, I guess, a punk supergroup.
Cool.
And we rehearsed and wrote a few songs just for this one, because we all loved that. It was our favourite show. Mm-hmm. That had given us all so much. And we then after the show, we decided to stay together. And so I definitely remember those rehearsals. That band was quite cathartic and full on, yeah, emotionally very dramatic, you know, and we all wore black clothes and we were very sort of dark. And then when we started The Sugar Cubes, I just took all my black garment and took them straight to the Red Cross. It was just like, I'm never going to wear black ever again, which I never did, actually. I remember being in, like, in cafes with my punk friend, and everybody would be black, and then somebody would be wearing, like, red socks, and we'd be like, all looking towards the socks. It's like, what are you doing?
Can't do that.
It was just so dogmatic. It's like, I'm insane. So I just, like, I'm never going to be that dogmatic ever again. You know, I'd done that. So Sugar Cubes were kind of the opposite. They were kind of quite lighthearted, and we were just the most radical thing you could do after a band like that was to be silly.
Go the other way.
Yeah, so we just became very stupid, really. And, well, at least that we thought was stupid, you know. So we started, like, writing pop songs.
Yeah.
Glinglow, 1990, was a jazz record. It's kind of definitely a jazz influence thing. When did you start falling for jazz music? Who are the artists that you loved listening to?
I would stay a lot, spend a lot of my time as a child at my grandparents' house, and they listened to jazz, especially my grandfather. And they would introduce me to like Ella Fitzgerald and Oscar Peterson and so these kind of things. So it was definitely one of the building blocks of my childhood. But I mean, at home I was listening to hippie music, and then I went to classical music school from 5 to 15. So I sort of got three angles, I guess. And then when we did the first Sugar Cubes album and got much international attention, and then we went ahead to do that difficult second album. It took us like a year or two to do it because it was just like, we got really hit hard with it. Like in the, like, wow, like how did we do this again before we got all this attention? Like, so these jazz guys in Iceland who are like, could be my grandfathers, you know, they're actually the same age as my grandfather, funnily enough. And then I picked, I think 20 songs in one day. I went to my friend who has an incredible collection of Icelandic jazz music. It's a very, very specific genre.
I'm about to say, yeah.
Very specific genre.
Precise.
And I picked 20 songs. We rehearsed them for one day, recorded them in one day, and then mixed it in one day.
Wow.
And I came back to the studio where the Sugars were working. It was like, okay, let's get something done here. So I always thought it was really flippant for me. It was very, I thought it was just not a joke, but just like, that insane five-day side project, you know, that would be forgotten. But funnily enough, in Iceland, that's like my most sold album there is. So, yeah, so basically that's the story of my Glinglow.
Kata Rokka, a track from Björk's 1990 foray into jazz, Glinglow, which was recorded with acclaimed Icelandic jazz group,
The Goodmunda Ingolf Sonar Trio. I hope I pronounced that right. I probably haven't. 808 states Graham Massey has collaborated with Björk many times over the years and is regarded as one of the people who helped introduce her to the world of electronic music. I asked Björk how they first met.
I was in it. You know, indie band, like, for 10 years, I guess. And I loved it. It was, like, my favourite people in the universe, but it was not exactly my favourite music. So when I heard about 808 State and Acid House and all this, I was just like, wow, this is me, you know. I'm not indie, I never was, and this kind of thing. And I ended up contacting Graham Massey. He was like, yeah, just come up, you know. So I like, at the time, like, you know, I asked my mum to babysit my son, and then I took the train to Manchester and hooked up with Graham Massey, and they wanted me to sing on their album, and I was just like, okay. And they gave me this song, like, on a Walkman, and I just walked outside in the rain in Manchester, in the rain, of course
Manchester.
It's the theme of the day, and wrote this kind of melody to it. Yeah, and then they took me to, like, clubs, and I saw the whole acid scene. I think it was 89. Yeah, so it was pretty exciting.
And that was Oops by 808 State, featuring Björk, of course, on vocals from 1991.
The first time on BBC Six Music. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, and my guest today, I'm pleased to say, is Björk. And you just heard Human Behaviour, Björk's first international solo hit, and the opening track of her 1993 album debut. That album saw her immersing herself in electronic music and a whole new range of influences, and the record became a massive worldwide hit. I asked her if she could remember people's reaction when the record first came out, and how she felt about becoming that successful.
Yeah, I remember playing first the songs to my record company, and they thinking, oh, this is really strange music. This is only going to do the third of the Sugar Cubes.
And they were wrong.
And I was like, oh, I don't care. You know, I just have to do it, you know, once in a life, my life or whatever. So when it became as successful as it did, it was a really big surprise to all of us. We were totally not prepared for it. And it was fun, you know, it was quite a ride.
You enjoy it?
It was really fun. And up to, you know, for a certain time, because, I mean, a certain amount of time. And then when I had sort of paparazzi, like, sleeping in my garden, it stopped being fun, you know. And I guess I was lucky enough to have tried that one. I bet everybody wouldn't mind trying that once in a lifetime, you know.
Just for a bit, just for a while.
But then you want to sort of step out of it, you know. And so I felt really lucky that I got to do that. But then in 96, you know, after 3 years of it, it was just a bit much. So I moved away and I'm lucky because I've still been able to just do my music, but I'm not like bothered in the streets and, you know, so I'm sort of right in the middle. So, yeah. So I had a choice. I could step out of it, which a lot of people can't.
As well as making her feature film debut in Lars von Trier's 2001 movie Dancer in the Dark, Björk also wrote the music for the soundtrack. I asked her what attracted her to her first acting project and what it was like working with such a famously difficult director.
Well, he offered me to write the music and I turned it down because I was busy doing a lot of other things. And then he was very insistent and kept like, right. You know, and I was like, that could be interesting. Then I did the music and to it and thought that would be enough. And that was quite enjoyable. And then he wanted me to act in it as well. And that's when it became a bit much. I did it for the music and I enjoyed doing the music. It's 12 years ago. So last century. It's before, 1999, right? So I listened back to it and I'm glad I wrote that music, you know? And I think people misunderstand a little bit because they think, oh, that made her never want to be in film anymore or whatever because it was so dramatic. Well, the thing is, it's actually the other way around. Like, I never wanted to be in movies and I had gotten some few offers before and I just always said, no, like, if I can make all the albums I want to make before I die, you know, I need like 5 lives to do that. So let alone if I start like acting as well, it's a bit... Because the project was of the nature it was, I made an exception and acted in it as well.
It's got I've Seen It All on it, which is the track you did with Tom York, which is just a beautiful, beautiful piece of music. Were you always a big Radiohead fan?
Yeah, I love him as a singer. I guess I'm you know, I have my love-hate relationship with guitar, bass and drums, you know, which at the end of the day is just a taste thing. It's not like it's right or wrong or anything.
So do they do. I think Radiohead have the same love-hate relationship as well.
Yeah, but definitely there's a lot of gorgeous songs they've done, like amazing. I mean, he's one of the best singers around. He's incredible.
I've seen it all. I have seen the trees. I have seen the willow leaves dancing in the breeze.
Killed by his best friend and lives that were over before they were spent. I've seen what I was and I know what I'll be. I've seen it all. There is no more to see.
Thank you.
missing one little spark. I have seen what I choose, and I've seen what I need, and that is enough to one more would be grief. I see.
The light and the dark, the fake and the small, just keep in mind you need no more at all. You see what you're and you know what you'll be. You see it all, there is no love to see.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music with my guest, Björk. In 2007, Björk released her seventh studio album, Volta, another surprising move forward stylistically. Produced by Timbaland, it's a much more beat-heavy and tribal-sounding work than its predecessors. I asked her about how the collaboration with the R&B and hip-hop producer first came about.
Back in when I was a teenager, I was listening also to things like Earth and the Fire a lot, and Chaka Khan, and these kind of things, like Quincy Jones stuff, you know. His project's always been curious for me. And then Public Enemy, I was totally obsessed with. I guess that's not R&B, I guess.
No.
I don't know what that is. Yeah, hip-hop, I guess. Radical hip-hop.
Still, to this day, they sound amazing.
Yeah, I think it's pretty... It's like orchestral, like sonically. If you just play it, it's like... You know, it's like Miles Davis album or something. It's really out there. But I mean, Timbaland, he sampled my song Yoka. So he was always... Like, he was sort of interested in me and wanted to work with me. And I was like, wow, that sounds a bit odd. I mean, really flattered, but I just didn't see it happening. Mm. And then by the time I was doing Volta, I was kind of, that album for me was sort of tribal, I guess. So I was just like, that tribe and that tribe. And then I had a Chinese beeper player, and there was Konono One from Congo, and Tumani Diabate from Mali. And so... And me, including being from the Icelandic tribe. So that was sort of the album I contacted Timbaland and say, you up for being a tribe? And yeah, so that it sort of came from that angle, I guess.
Ooh.
That was Björk's track Crystalline from her new album Biophilia. As has been documented extensively, the new album is available on a series of multimedia platforms, including the iPad. And there are bespoke iPad apps for each of the songs. I asked her when she first got the idea for such an ambitious project.
My intention was to simplify things.
Right, hasn't worked then, no?
I guess once I started simplifying, it became addictive and I wanted to simplify everything. No, I guess it was just a lot of things that perhaps were out of date that I wanted to sort of update. You know, for example, the electronic music is very often on a grid, like 4-4, you know, and that grid doesn't have to be that rigid. You know, now we have such sophisticated technology. The grid can be, you know, water, or it can be, you know, yeah, the moon pulling the ocean up and down is actually one app. Or it could be, the grid could be a lightning, you know, and or it could be viruses multiplying. So I was like, okay, now we can reunite technology with more organic things, you know. So it's not, electronic music is not cold anymore. So for me, I was like, okay, let's simplify this. There's always been this wall between electronic music and more like organic, tactile,
yeah,
things that
natural.
That, yeah, that, you know, most musicians, when they play a drum or a guitar, it's something you hold in your hands and you squeeze it and you hit it and you don't necessarily decide what you're going to do beforehand. You're just fiddling about and then suddenly there's a song there, you know. And that's always been a bit tricky with electronic music, you know. But now you can. So it sort of started with the touchscreen, trying to break that wall between, and also kind of how I've always seen musicology. You know, for example, a rhythm in a song or a shape of a song, I always connected it somehow with nature. You know, like, okay, this song is sort of like a mountain. The verses, you're in the valley, and on the chorus, you're on the top of a hill. You know, so that you can do, you know, on a touchscreen.
And just finally, we have to get you to pick a song. This will be the final song that gets played out. It could be anything you want. It can be one of yours. It can be something you've loved from your childhood, or at any point. It's the final song we play in the show.
Yeah, how about Willem's Scream with James Blake?
Why do you love that so much?
I don't know, maybe you just feel the effortlessness of the fact that he both programs and produces the songs and also sings and writes the music. So it's just really, in its simplicity, it's very complete somehow. I saw him play a show in New York a few months ago and it was amazing.
Then we shall play that. Thank you very much. It's been lovely to speak to you. I don't know about my love.
falling, falling, might as well falling.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Radio 6 Music documentaries, telling the stories in music that matter.
Through my teenage years, I started understanding the inner workings of a speaker, the inner workings of an amplifier. That's how I came up with this technique on the turntable.
From Grandmaster Flash and the evolution of hip-hop to the biggest rock bands in the world.
We own the triumphs and we own the disastrous failures of our 32 years together. But it's this beautiful thing called REM, and for me it was really important that the legacy remain intact.
Updated daily on BBC Sounds. Right now, it's the 6 Music Jukebox.